Good morning, everyone. I didn't get a single good morning back. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Looks like the last people in the back, I'm sure people will keep trickling in, is some people from Rocky Mountain Labs here? Yeah, welcome. How about NIEHS, North Carolina contingent? Go Heels, it was a bad week. Anybody here from Phoenix? Yes, welcome. We're delighted. Farmingham, Massachusetts. Well, I know some people are registered, so hopefully they'll find their way. Frederick, did you come on the bus? All right, so the bus made it. Baltimore, Bethesda. Okay, so the entire NIH community is here today. And I am really delighted. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Sharon Milgram. I'm the director of the Office of Intramural Training and Education. So I actually work for you. You'll be having to fill out my performance evaluation soon. But I hope you'll get to know me over time. I've been at the NIH almost a year now. My lab is in the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and you can find me most of the time in my office in Building 2, where the rest of the Office of Intramural Training and Education staff are. I would like, before I make a couple of brief comments and then turn the floor over to the main events today, to ask everyone who was on the planning committee for this event to please stand up. Great. Thank you. I don't remember when we started meeting, but it was a long time ago. I actually think it was before I knew how to find my way around Building 10. So it was really a long time ago. I would also like to thank all of the speakers. We got almost 100% enthusiastic yeses, and the people who couldn't come because they had some conflict said, please invite me next year. So that is, I think, both indicative of just the really positive spirit and energy in the science community, and it's also indicative of the fact that NIH fellows and graduate students are an interesting bunch of people, and people are willing to get out of work for a day and get on a plane or walk down the street if they're here on campus to spend a day with you. So I really appreciate all of the speakers who are able to make it. Thank you very much for those of you who are here. Finally today, sometime when you have a chance, if you see an OITE staff person, they're all wearing white shirts. They're the people at the tables. They're the people who will be making sure we get everyone through lunch efficiently. Introduce yourself. We are all here to make sure that you have a productive experience at the NIH and that you move on to a really satisfying career. So if there are things that we can do today or beyond, please introduce yourself, find us. My goal is, to meet all of you today, so grab me during the break, grab any of the OITE staff and introduce yourself. So I actually woke up this morning at 4:38. I actually beat the dog up, which is hard, because she seems to be an early morning dog. So I woke up at 4:38, unbelievably excited. What a day. All this positive energy, all these people ready or thinking about or actually in the process of making the next step and moving on to a great career, and this is just going to be this amazing day of positive energy. And then I actually had a little bit of coffee. And I thought, Sharon, what the hell? That's not true. This is really a room full of nervous, stressed, confused, stressed again, stressed some more people worried about making the next career step and what to do and will I be happy and will my partner be happy and will I find the job I want and will it pay enough and will it be satisfying 5 years from now? And I thought, okay, so really energetic group of people looking forward, taking control. Really nervous, stressed group of people wondering what's going to happen. And I think that the thing is that you're sitting here and you're doing the work that you need to do to make this step easier and more fun and more productive. And so I am going to bet the latter, that this is going to be a day of unbelievable positive energy, unbelievable education and learning and communication and networking. The thing to remember is each of the people sitting up here in these panels was sitting at one point in their career just as nervous, just as confused, just as uncertain as you, and here they all are, excited to come and talk with you about their career and about where they were, how they got there, what was important. So if you can just put away some of your nervousness and doubt and worry about the future and look at the role models that are here who have made steps in their career, who have changed careers, who have meandered in indirect ways to exactly what makes them happy, who have been able to evaluate and reevaluate and reassess along the way. If you can just look at all of these people and believe that someday it will be you sitting up here on these panels telling funny stories about those awful first job interviews, then I think you will really, really have an unbelievably productive day and an unbelievably productive time at the NIH. There is no doubt in regard to job searches and in regard to making your mark in science, either at the bench or away from the bench, that it is the prepared people that have all the lucky things happen to them. All of the, I met someone and I was just chatting and they told someone who told someone and here I am at a job interview. Those are the people who worked on their networking skills, who developed communication skills, who figured out how to communicate in the lab and outside of the lab to scientists and to their grandmothers. It is really yours to shape. This is an unbelievable time of opportunity in science. It is also an unbelievable time of challenge in science. The shrinking or stasis of the NIH budget, changes in our economy, global health issues, global financial issues, there's no doubt that this is a challenging time in science. But every day in the OITE Career Center, we hear about people with interviews, with jobs, negotiating higher salaries, getting startup packages that they want, getting moving money, getting stock options. So people are getting jobs. But it is really the prepared people. It is really the people who look carefully inside and say, what do I need to do to make this happen? So today, I hope for all of you, is a big step in that direction. Today also marks the official grand opening of the OITE Career Resource Center. We have counselors available full-time to help you with your job search, to help you talk through career options, to help you develop better networking skills. Whatever it is that we can do to be sure that 15 years from now or 10 years from now or 5 years from now or next year, you're sitting here up on one of these panels sharing your experiences, that's what we're here for. So take advantage of the Career Resource Center. We travel to all of the NIH campuses, and when we can't travel, we are available by phone. It works. Hopefully by next year, we'll have a little bit better video conferencing, but the phone actually works. It really does. I know it's an old-fashioned thing, and that it's easy to forget, but the phone really works. So whether you are here in Bethesda or far away, whether you spend 2 minutes walking over here today or had to get on a plane early yesterday, take advantage of all of the resources that we have to offer and have a really, really wonderful day. This is a special day for the NIH. The Office of Intramural Training and Education has been debated in meetings and in white papers for many, many years. The search for a director and the discussions of how to organize the office took a long time. And everybody really wanted to see a Career Resource Center on campus. And today I actually say, come, we're open, and we're here to serve you. So please take advantage and come see us. So with that, I am going to introduce Dr. Kapil Bharti and Philip Wang. Kapil is a member of FELCOM and a postdoctoral fellow in NINDS. Phil is a graduate student in the Graduate Partnerships Program with the University of Maryland. He's in the Hearing and Deafness Institute, and they're going to introduce the keynote speaker for today. Please find me during the breaks and whenever. I'm delighted to meet you all, and welcome to the first annual NIH Career Symposium. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon, for everything. So let's give Sharon another round of applause, everybody. Because without her, this day really wouldn't be possible. Well, good morning, everyone. It's a great pleasure for us to help introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Peter Fisk. So Peter is a true Bethesda native. He grew up in the neighborhood of Wood Acres, just to the south of campus here, and he went to school in Bethesda throughout high school, where he attended Walt Whitman High. Peter's father is a true inspiration for him in his career. His father was a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey and later the Smithsonian Institution, and he led a truly magical professional life where he traveled around the world investigating active volcanoes, and each summer took Peter and the entire family across the country to partake in his geological fieldwork. And so it is with this adventurous view of science growing up that Peter received his bachelor's degree, magna cum laude, in geological and geophysical sciences from Princeton in 1988. He was subsequently awarded an NSF graduate fellowship and received his PhD in geological and environmental sciences from Stanford University in 1993. On top of that, he received his MBA from UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business in the spring of 2002. Peter is currently the president and CEO of PEX Mixer Incorporated, a new company created to commercialize high-efficiency mixing technologies. And we really encourage you to learn more about Peter's work in industry in the program and at the research and industry panel later here today. And so some of his accomplishments include winning first prize at the annual UC Berkeley Business Plan Competition in 2001, and he was selected as a White House Fellow and Special Assistant to the Undersecretary for Acquisition and Technology at the Pentagon in 1996.
We can easily spend the whole morning talking about Peter's achievement. I won't do that because I think we need to give him some time to talk. But I do want to take a couple of minutes to talk about his achievements in the field of career development. Peter is not only regarded as the top lecturers and authors in this field, he's also someone whose advice in the field of career development is taken as highly realistic, yet critical, and optimistic, supportive, and practical. He's the author of the top-selling books, the first edition of which came out in 96. The book is titled To Boldly Go, A Practical Career Guide for Scientists. The next edition of this book came out in the year 2000, and the title was Put Your Science to Work. I cannot stress enough the quality of this book. If you're looking for advice in any fields of career planning, self-assessment, job hunting, interviewing skill, these books will help you through. Presently, he writes a monthly career advice column for AAAS. The column is called Opportunities, so take your time to read this column online. Let me read you a few lines from this column. That it's one of the columns that he wrote in November 2007, and the title of the column is The Golden Chapter. It just helps you think how much he thinks about us researcher. So he writes in this column, The difficulty new PhDs often face in leaving academia for the wider worlds of industry, government, and other non-traditional career paths, such as business or law, is evident. Although PhD programs do a marvelous job in preparing young scientists for careers in academic research, they don't provide much preparation or even an exposure to other career paths available to young scientists. And the worst is that our professors often project indifference or contempt for any career paths other than academic research, even though most PhDs end up outside this ivory tower. So I'm sure he will give us a very realistic and optimistic solution to this ivory tower issue. So without any further delays, please welcome Dr. Peter Fisk.
Well, thank you very much, everybody, and thank you for being here. It's not just, because it's nice to have a big crowd of people to talk in front of, but Also, it's really nice for me because, as you'll kind of learn in the next 45 minutes or so, I come at this conversation very much from personal experience, because I was, as Sharon said, very much in that seat those years ago, not really knowing much about my future and sort of in, frankly, quite a state of panic. And so that's why I'm here. I'm here because back then in 1996, when I was finishing up and in my postdoc, it was a very grim time for physical scientists. In fact, there was headlines like black hole opens up in giant scientist job roles, and we were all darkly joking about which cab company we'd be working for at the end of our PhDs. Well, and then here we are today in 2008, and here's your world, a world where NIH was gleefully allowed to double its budget and then allowed to explore the horrors of what the second derivative of budget changes are with time. And this, of course, has hit young scientists particularly hard because we see the number of R01 applications, success rate going down, et cetera, and, of course, expanding population of postdocs. You all are very familiar with this because you're living this life. And so that's all I really want to say about evil, bad statistics. But that's not why I'm really here. I have to admit to you that I have an agenda in doing these sorts of workshops. I give about 12 of these a year. And why I'm really here is, first of all, to tell you about my experience, because my career path so far has been unusual. If you talk to my advisor, he might even say somewhat checkered. But it's been enormously stimulating and very enjoyable. And I've benefited from numerous mentors, and I've had a lot of good advice along the way. So part of me, as scientist to scientist, young-ish scientist to younger scientists, is a desire to sort of tell you a little bit about what I learned in my own somewhat painful process of finding my own way. A second thing that I am doing this for is out of some real genuine concern, and the concern that I experienced myself, and that is that young scientists and engineers don't get very good career development advice, and that this advice is of greatest value to you at the early stages of your career. And, you know, I honestly tell you, back when I was a graduate student, we didn't talk about alternative careers. In fact, if you let it be known that you were even in some way deviating from the glorious hallowed path of academic research, you risked facing real approbation on the part of your advisor. I finally have to admit to a certain amount of chauvinism. And the chauvinism is this. I believe that technically trained people like you have an enormous opportunity to improve the world. And one of the things that's often very discouraging for me, as I even look at my own past, is that there were periods in my life where I had so much great experience and so much opportunity, but at the same time I felt like my options were so narrow. And so I hope that if you come away with nothing from my next set of slides and comments, it's that I want to show you a little bit about what might actually be possible for you. And possible for you not just in your own personal career, but also in the possibilities that you have to, in fact, change the world. When I was first dealing with this issue, I was in my fifth year at Stanford. I was 6 months away from graduating. My advisor had shown me a postdoc possibility in France, and I had no other clue as to what I was going to do. And it was a funny time because I was in the Stanford bookstore and I saw a book with this image on the cover, and for me it captured precisely how I was feeling at the time. Because this image reminded me exactly what life in graduate school was like. Graduate school in academia, the world seems so simple, doesn't it? You know, you have this academic path laid out before you, and you know, you all are life scientists. You know what the life cycle of a scientist should be, right? It's undergraduate, graduate school, postdoc, 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 assistant professor, tenured professor, retirement, death. It's this nice, easy cycle, right? And the paths are really clear, and the stars are in the sky, and it's all so simple. But then for whatever reason, I poked my head out from underneath this simple, wonderful, naive world. And what I saw was very confusing. And what I saw was actually something I didn't understand. I didn't know about the outside world and all these other things that people were doing. And it was very frightening and even confusing to initially explore these non-traditional career paths. But with time, I found some great people, some marvelous stories, some of which I'll tell you about today, And I eventually found it liberating and even empowering to find out where PhD-trained people had gone and the marvelous things that they'd done. Well, in today's economy, more than just the scientific job market is changing, and there's some important trends that will affect you no matter where you end up in your career. Because I think that there was this old paradigm in the U.S. economy about, you know, jobs, and it was things like you go to school and get skills, like, you know, filling up your gas tank, and then you get a job for the rest of your career. You look for job security, that was good. You look for wages, that was how people were rewarded. Infrastructure in a company was the biggest asset. And the other thing that proliferated was seniority was what mattered most. Guilds were everywhere. Risk aversion was the smart thing, and passivity is the safe bet. Today's economy, it's almost diametrically opposite. Now, lifelong learning is what matters. Risk-taking is now good. Stock options are the biggest reward, especially for technology people like us. And intellectual property is the biggest asset for most companies. Furthermore, experience is what matters most. Independence, that is to say consulting people, are everywhere. Risk management is the smart thing, and entrepreneurialism is the safe bet. My goodness. Well, the reason I bring this up to you is that, in fact, a lot of aspects of academia and national labs reinforce the old. And so there's often this greater contrast between how the outside world operates and how we as young scientists are operating inside academia. Well, so if that's the bad news or the challenges facing you, most of what I have to talk about is actually good news, as Sharon alluded to. In the course of my own exploration of my career and what was going on with other young scientists like me, I found some really great and hopeful news. For example, Neil Lane, a wonderful former director of the National Science Foundation and science advisor in the Clinton administration, wrote in an article in Science Magazine, young people themselves don't realize how valuable they are with a PhD. It means an ability to think deeply, solve problems, analyze data, criticize and be criticized. Science-trained graduates often don't realize the breadth of what they're capable of doing. And in fact, I did learn in the course of interviewing literally hundreds of PhDs turned lawyers, doctors, congressmen, bankers, business people, that the PhD experience actually instills in you some of the most important traits and skills that are not just transferable, they actually have the highest value in the outside world. So what am I talking about? Well, during the course of my initial stages, I really didn't know where to go and where to turn to, so I went to Stanford's Career Planning and Placement Center, and this was before they had any counselors for graduate students at all, and I met with a wonderful counselor named Al Levin. And in the course of telling him my woes about what I was going to do in graduate school and my uncertainty about whether I even wanted to follow an academic career path, he gave me some homework and told me to go back to my office and do the following. He said, Peter, I want you to take a piece of paper and write down all the what I would call transferable skills, the things that you feel like you've developed while in graduate school that are very valuable but not part of the technology that you developed, you know, as part of being a scientist. And so I went back to my office, and I sat down and I wrote, well, I've certainly learned the ability to function in a wide variety of environments and roles. Teaching skills, conceptualizing, explaining, I certainly had to do that. Counseling, interview skills, public speaking experience. I thought that a lot of people didn't realize how much public speaking experience scientists go through in the course of getting their degree. Ability to support a position with argumentation and logic, designing complex studies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I kept writing and writing and writing and writing. And you know what? I felt pretty darn good about myself at the end of this exercise, which I think was Al's first message to me. And as I will explain, I think that it's very easy for us as scientists to define ourselves in terms of the technical skills that we have. I am a mass spectroscopist. I am a NMR spectroscopist. And not think about ourselves as broadly adaptable problem solvers. Most people don't realize that a science degree teaches them this thing. Well, in addition to transferable skills, I think there are a range of personal qualities that people in the sciences have in abundance. Well, let's face it here, my friends, you wouldn't be here at NIH if you weren't at least slightly brighter than average. And what's funny about you people is that you were really smart high school students, and so you trotted off to college with all those smart students, and then you were in that cohort of smart people, but oh no, you all went on to grad school with those smart people, and even some of you are now in postdocs with those smart people. And you find yourself in this population, maybe feeling average, or like even below average, not realizing that you're already 4 standard deviations away from the rest of the population of the planet. You're just hanging around with the rest of the geeks, and you kind of think that you're average, but you're not.
When I have shown employers in all fields this very list, and I said I know people with these qualities, they love this list. They think that's great because these people are problem solvers. These are proactive people. And when I tell them also that they're able to survive on $1,500 a month for 5 years, they're truly impressed. One of the other things I've done is I've interviewed PhDs who've gone to a wide variety of fields and asked them a bunch of questions about the PhD experience. And one of the questions I love is, of the many skills you developed while in graduate school, which ones are the most valuable to you now? And I've had a host of wonderful answers, including finding one's own path and taking initiative with little assistance, ability to work in a high-stress environment, some of you are nodding, independence, maturity, computer skills, circumventing the rules, one of my favorites, learning to seek out problems and solutions, ability to persuade, ability to create, ability to work productively with difficult people. But my favorite, one woman wrote, grad school gave me the ability and courage to start something even if you don't know how yet. And, you know, I read that and I thought, you know, that is exactly what the PhD experience is like. And as a pedagogical philosophy, it is profoundly different than other forms of professional education. Because if you think about it, now I've got an MBA, so I can really contrast those two degrees. In the case of the MBA, this two-year program, what they do is they take you in, they sit you down in rooms like this, they lecture at you, they have you read case studies, you read books, you answer tests, you drink lots of beer, and at the end of the 2 years, you get a degree. You're kind of given a book of knowledge, asked to regurgitate it, and out you go. In the case of the PhD, what they do is at the young, tender age of 22 or 23 or 24, they literally march you to the precipice of human knowledge and tell you that over the next 5 years, you have to take the next step. And they don't tell you how. And the initial concept of the project that you and your advisor work together, it's uncertain whether it will work. And that level of risk and that level of uncertainty is a lot more like what the real world will present you as a professional than what the MBAs learn. In fact, if we trained MBAs the way we train PhDs, what we do is bring them into the auditorium the first day, say, welcome to your MBA, start your companies tomorrow, and we'll see you at the IPO. Bye-bye. And I think this is an important thing, because while it's an extremely grueling experience, and it can honestly often feel very degrading and demoralizing, this difficult work that you're doing is teaching you to be very strong, and strong in ways that a lot of other degrees don't give you. Well, so if this was a summation of, like, PhDs, obviously at this point we'd be running the world and, you know, captains of industry, and I don't know if you've noticed recently, but we're not actually running the world. So there must be some barriers for us. What are these barriers? Well, clearly one of the barriers that exists, the barriers that the outside world perceives of us as PhDs, okay? Now, when your name or your resume with PhD at the end of it floats across somebody's desk who's not familiar with PhDs, or when your cousin or your cousin's friend hears it, oh yeah, my cousin's got a PhD, what do you think the first image is that comes across their mind? Well, it's something like this. Now, this may be cruel and unfair and horribly, you know, caricaturish. And let's deconstruct this a little bit, because we have this unwashed hair, this little fellow with his pocket protector, no sense of deadlines, no wristwatch there, unsophisticated, fashion nightmare. But look here. Very, very smart. People see PhD at the end of your name, and they think that you're a genius. They think that you're a rocket scientist. In fact, they think that you're practically a re-embodiment of Einstein. In fact, they think that you're a lot smarter than we know you actually are. And so actually, one of the powers of the PhD in the broader world is it is easy for you to dispel the negative stereotypes. It is easy for you to dress professionally like the MBAs do, communicate effectively like the MBAs do, run your career and act professionally like they do, but be a PhD and have everybody assume you're a genius, at least as long as humanly possible. If those are external perceptions that might hold us back, I think actually the largest set of barriers that we encounter are internal to ourselves. And I call this kind of collectively the curse of being smart. For example, we have become very highly skilled. We've spent a lot of years investing in our technical skills, which means we tend to value those skills the most. We tend to ignore those other broader things that brought us along. we can conceptualize. We're very smart people, which means we can conceive of all sorts of complications to our actions. And, you know, that's the problem about having such a big brain, is you sit there and you're like, well, I could take that postdoc, but then this might happen. And you're kind of mapping out the probability distribution tree for the rest of your life with every course of action you take. And you guys are smart. You can do it. And, of course, you know that the end node of most of those, you know, branching points is, you know, death. And so you can lead a certain sense of indecision, a sort of analysis paralysis that we can be prone to. We're used to knowing it all. We're very smart people, which means we often fail to ask basic questions. And that's a combination of we assume that those basic questions have been answered by those giants upon whose shoulders we stand. And we also don't want to look stupid in a journal club talk or something when somebody's blathering on, and you're like, what the heck is he talking about? And you're sitting there thinking, God, I must be the only one who doesn't understand, and everybody's thought bubble says the same thing. We're intellectually smart, which means we often fail to appreciate other forms of smart, and there are other forms of smart. There are people who haven't graduated college who are running Fortune 100 companies, and they're not stupid people, and then daddy didn't give them the company. These are incredibly bright, insightful leaders who, even though they don't have lots of school training, have nevertheless become extremely effective in our economy. In academia and among scientists, we tend to have a sort of snobbery about this, and we tend to judge our leaders and our peers mostly on the length and breadth of their CV as opposed to some of the other things that they've done. And as a result, we tend to devalue some of those other types of leadership. And as a result, when we build teams, or even when we run organizations, we may not appreciate the value of some of those other forms of intelligence. Finally, we're used to being exceptional, which means we don't like to fail. And if you don't like to fail, if you fear failure, then every step you're going to take is going to be relatively incremental, which means even if you take a lot of them over the course of your lifetime, you're not going to travel very far. Another aspect of this issue is where we conceptualize where we can go with a degree in one field. And to illustrate this, I want to show you this two-column list. I've scrambled this up. On the left are people with PhDs in a certain field. And on the right is their present or recent job. And I want you to look at these two-column lists. I want you to think about the most obvious connections. You know, who's the most likely match for the PhD on the left and the PhD on the right? And I know you all are very curious about who the rodeo star is, and I'll tell you in a bit. But you've got a mindset because of your training. You think, oh, you know, probably mathematician, programmer, English book editor, all those great things, and that's probably, you know, likely. But here's the actual answer. Now, I raise this point not to say that what you do for your PhD will be utterly uncorrelated with what you do for the rest of your career. That's not my point. In fact, most of you who are chemists or biologists will stay in some chemical or biological field. My point here is that while the probability distribution has a large peak around the field that you're in right now, it has an extremely long tail. And in fact, there are PhD biologists and bioscientists who've gone across the entire planet doing any number of things. And so while in aggregate your probability is high that you might remain in your field, your individual possibilities span across the whole spectrum. And these are all real people. And in fact, I think one of the things that they will commonly tell you is that 5 years ago I would have never dreamed that I would have ended up here. I'll just have to tell you, because you're all curious, the geologist rodeo star is a friend of mine, Grady Grissom, who is, like me, undergrad at Princeton, like me, NSF graduate fellow at Stanford. He was also all-state rodeo championship in high school in Cody, Wyoming, where he grew up. At Stanford, he started doing amateur rodeo just because he enjoyed it. It was actually more fun than TAing a lab, he told me. And he ended up with a postdoc offer but decided to take a year off and try to make more money on the amateur rodeo circuit. And the rest, as they say, is history. He now lives in La Honda, California with two children, two daughters, and he makes horseshoe art. And one of the things that's interesting about Grady is, you know, I talked to him about, well, do you regret getting the PhD? You know, was that a waste of time? He said, no, not at all. I love it. I loved it. I loved the experience. It was a great adventure for me. I learned a lot about myself, and probably one of the most important things I learned is that I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. Another challenge that we have as scientists is we're very busy people, and we often fail to invest in ourselves. And this was illustrated to me in a comment I learned about in graduate school. At Stanford, we had a scientific advisory board. Very accomplished people would come back to the university every year and review our departments, et cetera. But one new member of the scientific advisory board insisted on having a private lunch just with the graduate students one year. We were like, oh, goody, we're going to dish. And she sat us down, and we talked about careers. And at a certain point, she was a remarkable person because she had finished her PhD only 10 years earlier in geophysics. She'd already risen extremely high in the oil company that she worked in. She was executive VP for exploration geophysics for all of Southeast Asia in just 10 years outside of her PhD. And I asked her somewhat glibly, so what's your formula for success? And she said, well, it's the 80-10-10 rule. I said, what's that? And she said, well, I'll tell you. She said, 80% of my time, I try doing the best job I possibly can do for my company. I really try to focus in on the critical issues. I try to exclude the urgent but unimportant stuff. I really try to add the greatest value I can and solve the most important problems. 10% of my work time, she said, I spend solely focused on my own professional development. I close my door, my secretary holds my calls, I read outside my field, I visit people in finance, I visit investment bankers, not because that stuff has anything to do with any of my projects or my job, it's solely focused on my own professional development. Then, she said, the final 10% of my time I spend telling as many people as possible what a good job I'm doing, the 80% of the time I'm actually doing my job. And we all had to chuckle at the time. But as I left that lunch, I thought, you know, so what could this mean to me as a graduate student? Well, what it would mean is in the course of a month, I would spend 2 days a month focused on my own professional and personal development. I might try to take a class or some seminar or something outside my field. And then those other 2 days, I would be trying to broaden my network and meet with people and tell people what I'm doing and what I'm interested in. Can I handle that? I'm thinking, okay, I think I can squeeze that in. You're all very busy people. In fact, one general, four-star general, told me that the definition of a real job was having more things to do than hours to do them. In fact, as you'll find out, the great art of management is figuring out how to blow things off. And in fact, one of the things you have to accept is you're going to have to squeeze some time out of your busy schedule to invest in yourself if you're going to get anywhere. Also, there are skills that really do count that we don't necessarily talk about in science as being valuable, but we know that they are. Leadership, persuasion, humor, tact, understanding of risk and reward, understanding of investment return, organization, sensitivity, drive, perspective, creativity. I think you all would read this list and think, yeah, those are important. But when was the last time anybody in a graduate department talked about these skills as being critical to success in science? One of the good things here is that a lot of these skills can be cultivated. These aren't, you know, things that exist on your 17th chromosome. These are things that people learn. And they learn by experience. And while you're a graduate student or a postdoc, you actually can create opportunities for yourself to take leadership, you know, opportunities in your organization, to practice extemporaneous speech, for example, to be an organizer. I showed this list to a number of recruiters, and they say, give me 10 people who have all these skills, and I could do anything. One of the things that employers particularly appreciate is they often don't just hire people for their skills today. They hire people for their growth potential. McKinsey Management Consulting said that, distilled this specifically to a phrase. They say they look for natural athletes. They look for people who are strong and competitive and can adapt to a wide variety of situations. And you know what? McKinsey and a bunch of other management consultancies have found a lot of those people in PhD programs. Well, there's some typical questions faced by scientists and science grads facing an uncertain job market. Questions like, how do I get a job in X, you know, investment banking, intellectual property, congressional staff position? How do I write a resume? What jobs call for my skills? Where's the bathroom? I'm going to be sick. It's a very stressful time for people. But there are better questions, and I want to talk to you about these questions. What do I enjoy doing and what am I good at? What are various careers like? What careers and jobs are a good match for my skills, interests, and values? And perhaps most importantly of all, who can I talk to? Okay, why are these questions better? Well, as I said earlier, scientists and engineers are preoccupied. We're preoccupied with matching our technical skills. We often ignore other important factors in choosing a career. Factors that matter, like, for example, where you want to live. I mean, I'll tell you, one of my most discouraging conversations with my advisor, with whom we're, you know, we're still very good friends, but he told me at a certain point, Peter, if you're really serious about a career in science, you should be prepared to move anywhere for that job. And I was like, okay, Jonathan, yeah. But inside, I was like, oh, man, I'm having trouble with that. Does that mean that I'm a bad scientist? Does that mean that I'm just somehow not committed? Well, no, it means that I have a different set of values. Scientists and engineers lack information and exposure to other career fields. Let's face it, the ivory tower happens to be a very apt metaphor for the world we live in. Career change for scientists and engineers can be harder. There's, as I said, a lack of an established pathway outside of the academic pathway. There's even fear or anger over getting a degree for nothing, and even ignorance and fear of life in the real world. You know, you're sitting there, and it's like, hey, you know, I get to come to work. I've got to get my schedule, get to dress the way I want. The hours are long, but the pay is low, so kind of all works out. But, my friends, if you don't like what you do for a living, you probably won't be very good at it. And the corollary of this law is also true. If you love what you do for a living, you'll probably be fine and enjoy yourself, including being a scientist. Nothing about what I'm saying here is an exhortation for you to leave science. Science is a wonderful career. I'm doing science now, running a technology company. But in a very different form than what I learned in graduate school. And there are lots of very satisfying places to be a scientist. But it's really fun to be a scientist when you can also feel like you're being effective. My book and a lot of my regular workshops stress this issue of career planning and career development. And career development is a methodology. It's a methodology that works, and that's why it's taught to MBAs and JDs and MDs and other people, but it's not taught in general to PhDs, scientists and engineers. And it's partly because there's a lot of misconceptions of what career development is. So in the latter 10 or 15 minutes of my prepared remarks, I'm going to blast through this structure. And normally, most audiences couldn't stand 30 slides in 12 minutes, but you all are PhD scientists, and you get this inflicted on you all the time, so here goes. It is not simply the process of writing a resume. It's not practicing your interviews. Career development starts with a process of self-assessment, an inward reflection on who you are as a person, your skills, interests, and values, and understanding that. On that foundation, you at the same time are doing a broad amount of exploration, exploring the wide world of work and understanding all the potential pathways that are open for you. Then, during periods of transition, when you come up on the end of your graduation or the end of your postdoc, or perhaps when you are not going to get tenure at that wonderful Ivy-encrusted institution that you loved so much, then you have a period of focusing on specific opportunities, specific scenarios that you can envision for yourself. With all that sort of preparation, then you go into the actual actions of applying for that job. Now, why go through all this? Well, for starters, I'll tell you something, it works. The people who go through this process of very diligently working through their system end up with a better resume and a better story to tell in an interview. They are more effective job candidates, and you will be competing against some of those people. And the other thing is that even if you aren't sure of your destiny and you have no worries, you will be having students and mentors come along behind you, and they could use some of this advice. Self-assessment comes in many forms, from informal methods, initial brainstorming, to self-guided methods, and even formal methods, these exams and instruments that people can use to explore your own skills, interests, and values. As you all know, you're life scientists. We are populations of Homo sapiens with very distributed sets of skills. We each have our neuroses, so figure out your neuroses and let them work for you. Figure out where your interests and strengths and weaknesses are and how to play to the strengths. In terms of initial brainstorming, it's simply asking questions like this. What do I enjoy doing most? What do I like most and least about my present career? What are my values? What do I like to read? What organizations sound interesting to me? When have I been my happiest at work? When have I been my most unhappy? For those of you in the throes of real career change right now, I strongly recommend you create something I call simply a career development journal. This is nothing more than a spiral notebook. And into that spiral notebook, you put in the notes of answers to questions like this. When you go for an informational interview, you put your notes from that in this thing. This notebook serves as a map. Because as I found, we are very high-functioning people. We like to be very, directed and very productive. And these sorts of types of exploration can be very nebulous and very nonlinear. and can be very dissatisfying. And by writing this down very quickly, you can end up seeing patterns and understanding your skills, interests, and values a little bit more. There are formal methods of self-assessment, some of which are now offered at NIH's Office of Career Services. I'm not going to go into these are defined in my book. But it's funny because these tools are not like, you know, Zoltan the Magnificent. They're not a fortune teller. It's going to tell you, you spit out a little piece of paper and say, you will be a dental hygienist. Oh, man. But they're interesting ways of teasing out what is of interest to you. Exploring the world of work is simply nothing more than one of those things you do in that 10%, in the 80-10-10 rule. It just means keeping your eyes and ears open, doing the things that people do to scan the environment for things that might surprise you. Like, did you know that the CIA has, you know, so many biologists on staff? What are they doing there? I wonder. Build your skills based. But most importantly, build your network. When I talk about networking to scientists and engineers, it's always the case that I sense this sort of kind of sucking in of breath, and people are like, oh God, he's going to talk about networking again. And it's, in a way, somewhat of an uncomfortable topic for scientists and engineers. We like to let our work speak for us, right? When we apply for a job, we have our beautiful CV and all our stack of reprints, and we send it off saying, there I am, judge me, you know? We tend not to feel as comfortable with this sort of schmoozy thing, you know? We tend to complain about politics and all those people. But in fact, I want to sort of unpack the concept of networking a little bit and sort of demystify it for you, because in many respects, it's nothing new for you guys. Networking is simply developing relationships with people, and in fact, people who share your personal and professional interests, and at certain periods in your career, alerting them to your career goals and abilities. It's not schmoozing. It's not restricted to slick and superficial people. In fact, anybody can be an effective networker if you simply try to understand who you know, and most importantly, who they know. As a young scientist, you have been networking your whole career. We just don't use that word. So, for example, when you go to a FASEB meeting and you give a poster presentation instead of a talk, why do we do that? Well, it's because you sit there for 3 hours, and of the 15,000 people at the meeting, the two other weirdos who care about your, you know, field come up and say, ah, it's a neat poster. What are you doing? Oh, well, I'm doing this. That's networking. When you are invited to give a talk at another department or another university, you go, you give a talk, you meet people. That's networking. You know, when you have go out to dinner with the journal club speaker, you know, after they give a talk, that's because it's free dinner, right? And, in fact, networking. So that's the sort of things we engage in all the time as part of us. It's not unusual. But if your networking is about relationships with people, then you ask, who is my network? The answer is anybody you have a relationship with. And what's surprising for a lot of people is that a lot of their latent power in the network is actually people they already know. Schoolmates, recent graduates, collaborators, friends, past bosses, family members. I met one woman who is now an intellectual property lawyer, and she discovered, you know, when she heard my talk and we had a long dialogue afterwards, she found out that her auntie worked at Bayer. She knew kind of worked at a pharmaceutical company, worked at Bayer. She actually worked in the marketing department, but worked closely with the IP, you know, lawyers at Bayer. And so when she was exploring IP law, her auntie set her up with three informational interviews with IP people at Bayer and ended up leading to a summer internship and eventually a job offer, but she went on to a private law firm. And so there's all these people you know lots of people. And that's the real power of the network effect of networking. And that is that these people here are not going to be the people to give you your next job. It's the people they know who are likely going to get you your next job. The most valuable people in your network are those who are already established in the career field that interests you and who are willing to give you help. So, for example, in the case of intellectual property law, say you've decided you're really interested in IP law. Your sophomore year college roommate is an IP lawyer in a firm in San Diego. Your auntie works with IP lawyers in Bayer. And you just spent the weekend at a IP and technology conference in Washington, D.C., and got about half a dozen business cards from various people who attended the things. That's a perfect way to take a network and distill it down to the few contacts who are the most potential value to you. And that's how a network works for you. Another resource, sciencecareers.org. This is where I publish opportunities. It's also a huge database of articles about people who've moved into all sorts of different careers across the range. And there are people like you, young scientists who've made the transition. And they are not only are there articles available on all these different career paths, but oftentimes people have left their email addresses. So you can actually contact them even 5 years later and say, hey, I read your article, and it was really interesting. I have some questions for you. That's part of networking too. Focusing is simply the process of taking that process of exploration and the process of self-assessment, which are, in some respects, subroutines, which should be running all throughout your career at a low level, and focusing them on specific opportunities when the time comes. And there are all sorts of ways to do this. You're good researchers. You're very good at doing that. Use those same research skills to develop your next opportunity. And there are all sorts of ways of getting on the inside track. Informational interviewing is one that I find extremely powerful for scientists and engineers, in particular because, as I said earlier, if you just appear to employers on paper as your name with a PhD at the end of it, there are sometimes some negative stereotypes. If you get in front of employers and show them that you're professional, that you're human, you actually have two arms and legs, that you don't wear a propeller on your head, that in fact you can turn that potentially negative stereotype about PhDs into a positive stereotype. Informational interviewing is the process of going to a potential employer or somebody who you want to learn more from and simply have an interview in their office. How do you get started? You get a point of contact through your network or their career planning and placement center. You contact them and say, hey, I'd like to come talk to you about this career field. You prepare questions in advance. The best kind of questions are those that can't be answered from what you can learn on the web. And at the point at which you're focusing, you're asking very precise questions. Some of the best people you can have an informational interview with are people like you, PhDs who've then gone on to these different fields. You can ask them very frank questions. Well, did your employer pay for your law degree? Or what were the rules surrounding, you know, being paid back for your law degree? Or do you really need to have this experience before you do that? Those are sorts of questions that you can't get answered in a job interview. You wouldn't even get a job interview if you didn't know the answers to those questions. But the most interesting thing I've found about informational interviewing is while it is not, you know, sort of schmoozing for a job, it is remarkable the number of times I've heard this happen. You go on an informational interview, you're scheduled for half an hour, you end up talking to this person for 90 minutes. You have a great experience, and then you give them your resume, say goodbye. A couple weeks later, they call. Hey, Sharon, I really enjoyed our conversation a couple weeks back. And in fact, after you left, I sent the resume around some other people in our group. And you know, while you were here, we didn't talk about this, but there's a new initiative in our company. And would you be interested in ... So suddenly you become the person that they think about. And I'll tell you, as a person who has recruited 12 scientists and engineers in two companies, I'm very interested when I have somebody contact me and say they want to do an informational interview, because it means there's a level of interest there. Something is propelling them towards me, and I'm at least curious to find out what that is. Some final advice about informational interviewing. Treat it like a formal interview for a job. Do your homework. Think carefully about what you want to learn. Prepare questions. Act professionally. Write a thank you note. Don't treat it like a job interview. Don't ask for a job, even indirectly. And don't speak with just one person and assume you have the whole story, although speaking with even one person is infinitely better than speaking with zero. Why are people willing to do this? Well, if they're scientists turned whatever, people like to give back. A lot of people got where they are today through chance encounters and random opportunities. And in fact, it's sort of like giving back to the great karmic well. Also, people like talking about themselves. Hey, it beats working for half an hour. I'll go chat to this person about how great I am. Finding fresh talent is critical to an organization's success, as I said, and information transfer is a two-way process. Sometimes people want to learn stuff from you in the course of an informational interview. There are lots of other ways of becoming an insider. My book chronicles real-life stories of people who've used each of these techniques for essentially developing their next opportunity. And I'll tell you that an academic job search can utilize many of these same quote-unquote insider strategies. There's nothing here that is not equally applicable to the academic search. I'm going to wrap up by sort of coming back to this issue of perceptions and realities and, in fact, overcoming stereotypes. Now, according to business people, academics and scientists are simple-minded about money, impractical about time, have no sense of deadlines, are socially passive, and value ideals as absolutes. They also may fear that you're a hermit and not a leader, that you're arrogant and not a team player, that you're a rebel and not an organizer, or that you're a problem person and not a solution person. I think it is very easy for you, in the course of your communications with employers, in the course of drafting your resume or cover letters, to dispel the negative stereotypes that might come with the image of a PhD, but to reinforce the positive stereotypes that people have. And also, don't forget your own misconceptions. It's very easy for us to sit here in the sort of scientific world and kind of snicker at all those people on Wall Street and cigar-chewing, martini-swilling, capitalist, whatever is dot, dot, dot. In fact, I found some incredibly intellectually stimulating and vigorous environments in the private sector. I've been very surprised by the professionalism and selfless cooperation that I see in business. And in fact, the more you see and the more you learn, the more you may appreciate the opportunities for thoughtful people outside of academia. I want to wrap up by giving you sort of what I call the myths and realities of the modern job market for scientists such as ourselves. One, find a job that matches your skills. Well, I hope you now believe that skills, values, and interests are all critical aspects of finding a fulfilling career. Thomas Friedman wrote in his book, Lexis and the Olive Tree, you always end up overvaluing what you know and undervaluing what's out there in plain sight. And that's exactly what we do. We tend to think of ourselves as techies and not think of ourselves as broadly adaptable problem solvers. If you define yourself very specifically in terms of your scientific discipline, your options will by necessity be very narrow. Myth number two, employers care only about technical skills. Oh, no. Employers care about a lot of things in addition to technical skills. They care about personality, degree of fit, leadership ability, learning ability, communication skills, persuasion skills, and drive. One hiring manager for a technical company said, we hire for attitude and train for skills. She was actually, this is a company that makes graphite products. And I asked her, even with, you know, PhDs, she said, especially with PhDs, she said, listen, nobody knows more about graphite, the chemistry and physics and material science of graphite than we do. Nobody can walk in the door and teach us everything. What we want are technical people who have an eagerness to learn, a desire and a drive to make a difference, and who want to be in this team. Myth number three, you should map out your career trajectory many years in the future. Well, I'm sorry. Didn't happen to me very easily. And in fact, serendipity, unplanned detours, and even quote-unquote setbacks are going to be part of your life. But the people who exploit chance opportunities, explore new areas, and even make the best of setbacks tend to be happier and more successful. And in fact, it's funny, I've often talked to people who are suffering the quote-unquote two-body problem. And what's interesting is of the two people, I've often found that the quote-unquote trailing spouse is the one who ends up with a happier job. Why? Because the first spouse feels a combination of so much guilt and, boy, if I'm moving the whole family, this is really important and this is very highly invested. The trailing spouse says, okay, well, I guess I have to open my aperture and think of other things. And in the course of doing that, they discover some things that are really fun. In my two-column list, one of those was an astrophysicist turned financial analyst who said, 5 years ago, I would have never predicted that I would have ended up here. Some final thoughts. Job hunting in the new century involves personal connections, chance encounters, and random opportunities. If you forgive a nuclear physics analogy, it's sort of like the more people you know, the greater your job cross-section. That's how people learn about opportunities, is through the people they know. Getting a job in science requires all the same job hunting skills and techniques as any job, including getting a job in academia. Thinking about finding a job is stressful, demoralizing, and produces anxiety. Actually doing something about finding a job can be liberating, empowering, and fun. As I said earlier, the more you enjoy what you're doing, the better you'll do it, and the happier you'll be. But something that really has motivated me to give these workshops, and that is that I believe I've met a number of wonderful people out there, PhD scientists such as yourselves, doing a remarkable range of things in the world. And you can serve science and society and your community in many different environments as a scientifically trained person. Don't be afraid to consider non-traditional career paths just because it's not familiar to you, your advisor, your department, or your family. Today, the world has got a host of extremely challenging problems. Most of those problems have a technical component to them. And the possibility exists for people like us, the next generation of scientists, to make the fundamental discoveries and improvements that can actually change the world. And I just say in closing that if I could magically sort of reconstitute this group in 10 years' time and each of you could stand up and tell the audience where you were today, I guarantee you that you all would not believe the breadth of places that you're going to go. And with that, I will tell you that this is also a carbon neutral presentation. All my business activity is offset with TerraPass. And if you're interested more in my columns or blog I was writing with Jeff Davis on NIH funding, you can find those here. But at this point, I'm happy to take your questions. Thanks very much. Sharon, how much time do you want for questions? There's actually an inertial. Yes.
Has it ever been fearful for you to step up and talk with strangers who you don't know yet? With all this networking, that's really, for me, the most. I want to crawl into a little hole.
Well, as the person who stood up to ask the first question in front of a huge room full of strangers, I have to say. But I appreciate your question because it's actually quite true when people have done things like Myers-Briggs evaluations of scientists as a profession or discipline, you'll find that in general we tend to be introverts, not extroverts. And there are aspects of the scientific career field that would have people maybe gravitate towards that. And I think that one of the things that's something to think about is that there are, no matter how nervous or uncomfortable you might be in some of these environments, there are some very interesting little techniques you can use, heuristics, to allow you to at least appear comfortable in front of a bunch of strangers. One of the ones I like is when you're heading in for an interview for the first time and shaking somebody's hand, make a mental note of the color of the person's eyes. That amount of time it takes to look at somebody's eyes and figure out if they're blue, green, or brown is actually, in America, about the right amount of time to make a connection. And what's interesting is that in some cultures, it's actually very impolite to look at somebody, you know, like that, especially in a job interview. But I found that, for example, with students who come from other countries, if you simply tell them, this is your assignment, figure out the color of your interviewer's eyes and then write it on the notes during your interview, they come back and say, thank you for doing that. I wouldn't have looked at them otherwise. And so I think that there are ways of figuring that out. Another thing, as I said in my slides about skills you can learn, such as leadership, humor, et cetera, there are resources around here where you can practice things like extemporaneous speech. One wonderful program is called Toastmasters International, and it's a volunteer organization around the world where people get together and practice extemporaneous speech. And in fact, we had a Chinese graduate student, Ning Xu, who was in the office next to me, and she did Toastmasters over the course of about 2 years. And it was hilarious how much she changed, because when she first came to Stanford, she was very shy, very uncertain of her English. And after 2 years of Toastmasters, man, you could not get this woman to shut up. And she really credits that as being a fabulous way in which she practiced extemporaneous speech. So those are mechanisms that you might use. Yes, next question.
So we've been told that publications are your golden ticket to any job, anything. That's your opening to everything. How important is publications to these alternative careers, especially the first author publication?
Well, I appreciate the question, and I'm going to answer it two ways. The first is, the direct answer is, I can give you my own experience hiring PhDs. I am interested in as much as the degree of publication up to a point indicate somebody's real level of self-sufficiency, and first author publications indicate that they have led something or been allowed to lead something. That being said, in some fields, the amount of publications sort of doesn't matter beyond a certain point. And so one of the questions I've often been asked is, you know, should I stay and do a postdoc for a couple years before seeking a non-traditional career? And it very much depends on the career field. Because other than having published a few papers, after that point, for all these other fields, investment banking, management consulting, that's irrelevant. And in fact, the longer you spend just publishing papers, the more you're directing your career more towards research. That's one way to answer that question. The second thing is that, of course, a community whose funding depends on publication rate would naturally say that the publication productivity of their graduate students and postdocs was very, very important for your future. It is actually principally important for their future. So I would say that the other aspect is that, you know, I have my I have a paper in Science Magazine. Woohoo! And so, yeah, that's on my bio. But most people don't know what even Science Magazine is. It's like they think, is that Scientific American or is that, do you have a crossword puzzle in that magazine? Like, no. Another version of that is it's very funny when I, you know, meet graduate students at various universities, and they say, I work in, you know, Phil Campbell's lab. And it's like, who the hell is Phil Campbell? I mean, it's like, you know, you think this is a, like a deity, but I don't know who the heck this guy is. And again, this is this problem that we have of this culture we live in. So I would say, if you had a choice, if it could be easily distilled down to this choice of publishing another paper or taking a course in quantitative finance or something way orthogonal to what you're doing now but would be part of the 80-10-10, I'd choose that. Next question.
Going back to the networking a bit, what do you do if you run into a situation where your primary mentor just doesn't believe in networking? How can you get that support in sort of trying to figure out who to talk to when you're sort of primary point of contact just doesn't seem to get it?
Well, that's a good question. I think that that question reflects a general challenge that young scientists have with mentors. Because even for you who have the most loving and generous mentor, these people are not, cannot be as invested in your future as you are, even if they're very well-intentioned. And so much like the parent-child relationship, there is some necessity as a young scientist to have a level of insubordination. In fact, I wrote a recent article about this. And I will just give you this piece of advice from a very sage mentor of mine from years, years back about insubordination. It's going to be necessary for you to do things that will piss your advisor off because they're the things that are right for you in your career path. And so, if you're going to embark on something that will piss your advisor off, my advisor's my mentor's advice was one, think carefully about what you want to get out of that investment in time and energy. Two, think about generally the consequences of being caught and how you're going to frame this in their eyes. And number three, make sure as hell that you don't get caught. That mentor was, of course, my older sister, Ann Fisk. So, and she was talking about our parents. And again, I would tell you that your mentor is not your primary conduit to the outside world, you are. The relationships that you develop, you need to own. And your advisor may even try to mediate some of those, but they're busy people. They got other people to worry about. So work between their feet, go around them, and make those connections directly. One other piece of advice along those lines, Peter Feivelman in his book, A PhD Is Not Enough, talked about the value of what he called research aunties and uncles, people outside your advisor's realm who could be collaborators. I found those collaborators extremely important for my career, so much so that I recommend for graduate students and postdocs to have at least one chapter of your thesis or at least one publication written with people outside of your lab. Because that's the bait, that's the bridging point at which you can bridge to other organizations. And those people don't have the same conflict of interest that exists with your own research group about maximizing your productivity versus what you're going to be doing next. One more question? Yes.
Yeah, if you have spent a very long time in science, let's say about 10 years, is it still possible to go to the outside world and, say, have a management consulting career? Is it easy or difficult to break, you know, the stereotypic barriers and, you know, try to transition into a different career?
Well, let me, that's a good question. Let me answer it two ways. One is you have several factors. Obviously, the outside world is interested in smart, bright people at any point. They're interested in hardworking, broadly adaptable problem solvers. If you frame yourself that way, and you frame your past research experience in terms of those things, I think you can look like a very attractive candidate. I will also say that especially mid-career scientists or even later scientists, once you get into your 50s, you then encounter all the same challenges that people later in their career have about career change, and that is, you know, am I now going to be competitive against people who obviously will look a lot younger than I? I would say that even if you've been in science for 10 years, you know, been in a postdoc for, you know, however many years, you're still younger than a lot of other people on the job market today. So by age alone, I don't think you're at too much of a disadvantage. And then the final thing I'd say is, you know, you've had these years as a scientist. You've been paid little. You've been extremely productive. By framing your level of productivity and your resourcefulness, you've had to, in a sense, remain young, whether or not you're actually young. So that's how I would frame it to an employer.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to be around at least through lunch and on the industrial panel, so I'm happy to take other questions, and I'm happy to have you guys contact me afterwards by my email address, peterfisk@yahoo.com. Thanks very much.
I have a couple of important housekeeping comments to make. So those of you who have a name tag that was is computer generated, those are the people who registered. Those of you who have a handwritten name tag, you missed the registration deadline. And that's irrelevant for the most part today, with just two small exceptions. We did our best to find lunch for everyone, but I am not certain that we will be able to accommodate those of you who did not register in advance. If you can just sit tight for a minute and let other people get through the line, we have figured out ways to do this efficiently. Obviously, we have no reason to have a leftover lunch, and as soon as we get a large group through and have an assessment of whether we're going to be okay, we'll open the line up. I really apologize for that. I spend more time thinking about food sometimes than other things, and we really have done our best, so I apologize up front if that gets a little chaotic. Nature is a big place, and so I thought, no problem, let's run five sessions every hour simultaneously. But what I didn't realize is that some of the rooms in Nature are very small. So there are a couple sessions where the number of people registered exceeds the numbers of bottoms we can put into seats. Again, if you did not register, there is a chance somebody will ask you to sit tight for a minute and make sure that we were able to accommodate the people who registered. That said, there are plenty of sessions with plenty of seats. And so don't get chased away. Just take a deep breath, and I have a good feeling it will all work out just fine, but we might need you to sit tight a minute. There are sessions upstairs. Are we upstairs? I don't know. There are sessions wherever we are not, upstairs and downstairs. It's a pretty busy, fast clip. There are restrooms on each side of the auditorium. And have a great day. Thank you all. And thank you, Peter.